Today, how the COVID-19 crisis caused European countries to turn on each other. When The Guardian's Brussels bureau chief, Daniel Boffey, set out to investigate what had gone wrong in Europe's response to COVID-19, he kept coming back to this week in late February and a cry for help from the Italian government.
The Italian health system was completely on its back.
Carla Maestrini and her colleagues have lost track of the hours they're working in the intensive care unit of Cremona Hospital.
The infection rate was tripling every couple of days.
Well, within the last hour, the authorities have said that the number of cases of coronavirus here in Italy has risen to 374.
And there are now people were dying in large numbers in clumps around, particularly in Lombardy.
The number of cases in Italy is now past 3,000, and 107 people have died.
And the Italian government was in nothing short of panic. At times of absolute crisis, there's a system where a member state can call on Brussels for help.
The request was made through the usual channels because we are connected with the member states.
And that call is echoed around the European Union to all the member states, to all the capitals, to say, can you help this country in need? That's what happened this time. Italy needed PPE, they needed ventilators, they needed them quick.
It is a very usual procedure in the EU that member states that feel that they have or that they may in the future need a certain item may request such assistance.
So they put in the request to the European Commission. The Commission sent it out through a digital service, and then there was silence, absolute silence.
It was a moment in which European solidarity appeared to fall apart. As countries scrambled to shore up their own defences in preparation for coronavirus, they felt either unwilling or unable to provide support to Italy.
It is also true that too many were not there on time when Italy needed a helping hand at the very beginning. And yes, for that, it is right that Europe as a whole offers a heartfelt apology.
5 months later, EU leaders would meet face to face for the first time to discuss what went wrong and what they could do to fix it in a bitter summit that stretched over 4 days, but did eventually reach a deal this week. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, how coronavirus tested the European Union. Daniel, at the start of the year, it felt as if the 27 countries of the EU were more determined than ever to pull together, to show their united strength, I guess to prove that Brexit wasn't going to shake the foundations. At that point, they were also just becoming aware of the looming COVID threat. How is the EU meant to function in a situation like that?
The EU's meant to function. They're meant to coordinate very swiftly when something like this, a pandemic which has no respect for borders, there should be immediate coordination. You know, the Commission President should be talking to Prime Ministers and heads of state of government. But we had a new European Commission President. We had Ursula von der Leyen, who is entirely new to Brussels.
This is not only an unprecedented challenge to our healthcare systems, but also a major shock to our economies.
And there wasn't that wisdom, there wasn't that knowledge of what Brussels can do. The problem is, ultimately, is that health is a national competence. It's up to the capitals to decide. There are these kind of half-cooked institutions there to support the member states. But they're born out of past crises which fizzled out, and we haven't had anything like this before to really give us the danger shot that we required. So it was a stuttering start from the beginning with institutions that are not really fit for purpose.
But they must have seen that these initial cases in China were spreading.
27 cases of viral pneumonia were reported earlier this week. All the cases were found to be related to a seafood market.
And it led to. So what did the key EU committee on this do?
So they had an initial meeting on the 17th of January for all the member states, their health officials, to talk about what was going on. But in a sign of how little resonance this pandemic had yet had in the capitals, just 12 of the 27 member states, plus the UK, who were due to attend, did attend.
Gosh, it really wasn't on the radar then. What did they discuss in that session?
One of the big issues to be discussed was what to do about those direct flights from Wuhan to London, Paris and Rome. And UK and France were able to share information about what they were going to do. The Italian government couldn't share what they were going to do because their official was one of the many absentees. The Italian representative hadn't noticed the email inviting him to the meeting. The idea was there would be some recommendations coming out of this meeting. There weren't enough people, though, to make a recommendation. And I think that was an ominous sign of all the difficulties that the Commission would face in this very early stage. The member states weren't tuned in.
So when did the EU really try to ring the alarm to member states about the danger Europe was potentially in?
So the 28th of January, von der Leyen set up a crisis coordination committee. The very next day, they were going to have a press conference.
Good afternoon, also from my side. As you know, the European Commission has a coordinating role when it comes to serious cross-border health threats in the European Union.
And they wanted to say, get ready to the member states. They really wanted journalists, reporters to pass the word back to the capitals because they weren't having any joy in doing so.
The Commission decided yesterday to step up our preparedness and response activities.
Unfortunately, that press conference fell on the very same day that British MEPs, UK MEPs, were having their last day at the European Parliament just 2 days before the UK left the European Union.
I know you're going to miss us. I know you want to ban our national flags, but we're going to wave you goodbye. And we'll look forward in the future to working with you as sovereign.
If you disobey the rules, you get cut off. Could we please remove the flags?
We also decided, for instance, to convene a press conference.
So I interviewed the Crisis Management Commissioner, Janez Lanacik, who was involved in that press conference, who was full of hope that he would be able to get the message out through the media, and he turned up to the press conference.
And it was almost empty. The press room in the parliament was almost empty.
As he said, he hoped that at least this echoey press hall, that there would be echoes leading all the way to the capitals.
There was a lot of echo because of the empty room. But we were still hoping that there would be some echo in the media articles next day.
And
we didn't find much of that.
But in reality, there was just no interest. Well, Lenarczyk was trying to sound the alarm over in the European Parliament, and I was there. It was kind of a party atmosphere. People were singing, holding hands. Drinks were out, and there's lots of crying, lots of tears. It was a really emotional moment. But because of all that, we just weren't listening.
And it was actually on the very next day that we knew for sure that COVID had arrived in Europe. Two Chinese tourists tested positive in Rome.
Since the announcement of the two confirmed cases, Italy has taken the decision to cancel all flights from China, the only government to do so. Meanwhile, the Chinese tourists are receiving medical help in a Rome hospital, and their hotel room has been sealed off.
By the middle of February, as you said, things were getting really bad in Italy. They sent out that distress signal to Brussels, asking for more PPE, among other things. Why didn't other countries respond?
PPE stocks, you know, stocks of masks, gloves, aprons, had dwindled down. They'd been allowed to get out of date and been destroyed, and they just weren't the stockpiles that you'd expect.
What do you mean they'd been destroyed?
Well, yeah, I mean, both in France and in Belgium, a load of masks and gloves had actually been destroyed because they'd gone out of date, they'd been destroyed, burnt.
Burnt?
Burnt, yep, yep. The key point is that at one stage, when, you know, following the SARS outbreak and the various influenza outbreak, the capitals were concerned and the idea of a pandemic was a big thing. So they stockpiled and then, frankly, they didn't bother to keep up. So those masks, they went out of date. The gowns went out of date, the gloves. And what do you do with stuff that's gone out of date? You have to destroy it because you don't want to end up in the market. So they were incinerating a lot of masks. So France held 1.7 billion protective masks in 2011, but now at the start of the pandemic, it only had 117 million. Between January and March this year, it incinerated 1.5 million masks.
But that is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, What you're saying is they were literally burning protective gear after COVID had started to spread. Surely you only incinerate stuff once you've got a replacement.
What I find extraordinary is that no one within the Commission, so no one in Brussels, no one at the European Centre for Disease Control and Prevention had any record of stockpiles of PPE anywhere in Europe. There was no central database, so no one really had a clue. And worse, the Commission is of the impression that the member states weren't sure what they had. People weren't keeping on top of this. They'd become complacent.
And that was PPE. Had Italy also asked for ventilators?
Yes. So they made a call. And Germany had a lot of ventilators, actually, at this stage, because they'd invested in public health.
There are also tens of thousands of ventilators in place and orders for many more, meaning hospitals have so far faced no mass influx of infected patients at the same time as happened elsewhere in Europe.
I mean, they've been criticised, the German government has been criticised over the years for it, wasting money. Why not spend it on the front line, nurses and doctors? Why spend it on all this equipment stuck in a warehouse, not being used? But when it hit, they were ready. But they weren't willing to pass it on to Italy because they knew now, by this stage, by the end of February, they knew how serious this was and they wanted to keep it for their own people. So what followed after the failure to respond to Italy, and it was stark, the Italian ambassador to the EU wrote an op-ed in the sort of Brussels bubble media.
In an opinion piece for Politico, the Italian representative to the EU has called for help, asking for medical equipment to be redistributed to those regions most in need.
Just castigating the lack of solidarity and talking about, you know, what is the European Union about if it's not about responding at this stage. So there's a lot of anger.
The very future of the European Union is at risk if it does not do more to help countries hit by coronavirus. That's the warning from the Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. He's told the BBC's Mark Lowen that the EU needs to rise to the challenge of what he called the biggest test since the Second World War.
But following that, Germany then closed its borders.
Europe's open borders are closing. Germany joins a growing list of EU countries to at least partially shut out their neighbours.
Germany and France started taking PPE off the marketplace and not allowing it to be exported elsewhere. So they not only didn't respond to Italy, they actually got in the way of anything through the private market getting to Italy.
Was there not a central stock from which equipment could have gone to Italy?
No, the European Union doesn't keep a central stock. That doesn't have the mandate to do so. It's one of the things the Commission wants to be able to do, but there was no such central stock. It's the tragedy of the commons, I think economists call it. It's something that you don't necessarily need today or tomorrow, but you might need in the future, and somebody needs to spend the money and have the foresight and spend money on it.
Wow, so essentially, when all these European countries who generally try to act in a kind of pan-European way were faced with this terrible threat to their own nations, they suddenly all put European solidarity second and actually began to behave in an almost competitive nature. I mean, you've described what Germany did. Did other countries follow suit? Were there other examples of countries acting in their own interests and not necessarily in solidarity with their neighbours?
Absolutely. 15 member states closed their borders. The French response to steal PPE off the marketplace, where it was traveling through France, they just took it.
France has itself been accused by a Swedish company of having requisitioned masks destined for Italy and Spain.
We had huge queues at borders all over Europe, and you know, this was stopping food coming through. This was actually getting in the way of the COVID response.
This was the traffic jam at the Franco-Swiss border, a four-hour queue affecting even essential workers like this nurse.
Our patients are waiting for us. Our colleagues are also waiting for us. These are still human beings. They are in their beds. They are waiting for blood tests. They are waiting for us to feed them. And here we go. We are stuck.
At times, it felt like it was a tit-for-tat thing. You know, if Germany's going to close its border, well, we're going to close our border. All the old divisions, the old Europe, seem to be back. The European Union does love the idea of freedom of movement. It does love the idea of the Schengen area. But everything seemed, all of a sudden, it seemed to go back 20 years.
It's amazing how quickly things can spiral in a different direction. How did the Commission respond to all of this?
With red-hot anger.
National governments have taken strong measures to limit the spread of the coronavirus in the European Union. This is necessary. But some of these measures have stopped people at the borders. At certain borders, we have dozens of kilometers of traffic jams and more than 24 hours of waiting time.
There were a lot of extremely angry phone calls from the Commission President to Berlin and to Paris. And you know, these issues, they were resolved pretty quickly. Within a few days, the borders were open again. But yeah, no, it was a messy thing, and it lasted for only a short time, but it really hit home in countries like Spain and Italy, the worst hit, that they couldn't rely on their partners when they really did need them.
But if you're locking down every country, doesn't it make sense for the borders to be closed?
Yeah, but if you need to lock down together, you want to do it all together at the same time, and that really will kill the virus. Otherwise, you have the virus absolutely massive outbreak, say, in your neighbouring country, and it will get into your country. So you need an outer, you need external control for Europe, not internal controls.
Afternoon, everyone.
On the 13th of March, the World Health Organization said,
Europe has now become the epicenter of the pandemic, with more reported cases and deaths than the rest of the world combined, apart from China.
Is there any sense that could have been avoided if there had been better coordination?
There were pinch points where throughout the crisis where member states were doing their own thing, and if they'd done it all together at the same time, they could have contained the virus, I think, much more. And certainly this is what the experts tell me. The director of the European Centre for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Andrea Mann, told me that she feels that the lockdown should have been earlier and more coordinated, and that could have saved lives, that could have flattened the infection curve, and that she worries that maybe she should have given advice earlier, and she worries that even if she'd given the advice earlier, that the member states as one wouldn't have listened.
I remember when China put the lockdown to Wuhan and the surrounding million inhabitant cities, people told me, look, this wouldn't be possible in Europe.
Yeah.
It's interesting when you think about it, because I have to say I was quite surprised to hear that so much of the COVID we got in Britain had come from other European countries like Spain, Italy, France. It sounds like what you're essentially hearing from experts within Europe is that if more effort had been made collectively to try to contain it within Italy, perhaps other countries wouldn't have been hit quite so badly.
So I was speaking to an advisor to Italian Ministry, Health Ministry, Walter Ricciardi, and he said, what was going on in Italy was evident, and people were shouting about the disease going out of control, and everyone thought it was just an Italian problem, and they didn't think of themselves and what they should do, and they didn't sort of talk to us about how we could work together to avoid this spreading across Europe. Health ministers were alive to the need to do things together and quickly, but they were talking to their prime ministers and to their finance ministers. The terror of the consequences of an economic lockdown was such that action was slow, very slow to come.
From all your reporting on this, what do the experts think needs to change to prevent these problems being repeated?
So they want a stockpile of equipment that Brussels has the power to purchase and then has the power to distribute according to priority, according to need. They want to vastly increase the amount of money that's spent centrally in Brussels on health, on public health. It's not glamorous, but it is what you need to do. And I think Brussels wants to have the right, the mandate to do it. So no one's talking about treaty change, but they are talking about just giving Brussels more, not power, but giving more influence, giving them the money and saying, right, we understand coordination's failed this time, make sure it works next time.
Coming up, divisions lead to a bad-tempered summit in Brussels. So there has been this real recognition across Europe of the problems the EU has faced in this crisis. And last weekend, for the first time, the member states convened a face-to-face meeting.
The European Union is at a crossroads, with member states looking for leadership and cash to bolster economies that have been hard hit by the COVID pandemic and subsequent lockdowns. Leaders are in Brussels for their first face-to-face meeting in months.
How do you even arrange a summit like that in the middle of a pandemic? What was the key aim of it?
Yeah, I mean, this was an utterly bizarre summit in that the meeting room had sort of fresh air pumped in. I mean, the leaders were literally taking in rarefied air. All the documents had to be wiped clean when everyone's touched it. Everyone had to wear a mask before they went into the meeting room. The media were locked out. We weren't allowed to be there because presumably we're super spreaders. So it was always going to be a difficult setup. The leaders have been talking for some months now, both about their long-term budget, which kicks in from, was meant to kick in from next year for 7 years. And then they wanted to do this big, huge economic stimulus package, a 750 billion euro economic stimulus package under the Commission, European Commission's proposal, which is an attempt to rebuild Europe's economy. Nothing short of that is kind of like a Marshall Plan for 2020. It is doing huge fiscal transfers from the northern member states. So, for example, Denmark, Germany, Austria, who had actually coped reasonably well during the crisis, to the southern member states, to Spain, to Italy, who had a nightmare. And questions are being asked about the democratic accountability of that.
This is about all of us, and it is way bigger than any of us. This is Europe's moment.
You're piling on national debt onto certain governments, and then you're sending all that money over to another country. There's the risk that taxpayers in the big financier countries, the countries spending the money, are going to get angry. And so this debate has been heated and horrible over this weekend.
And that 2-day summit ended up stretching to 4 days. And as you say, it was acrimonious, bitter, tortuous even. It was sleep deprived. It was only after a session at 5:15 a.m. on Tuesday morning that the EU Council President Charles Michel tweeted one word, deal.
This is a good deal. This is a strong deal. And most importantly, this is the right deal for Europe right now.
Tell me about the disagreements. What were countries arguing about?
The Dutch have kind of been billed, sort of painted as the bogeymen in all this. They've very much taken over the British mantle. So the first big issue is the Dutch are saying, okay, well, we're willing to have these big fiscal transfers, but we absolutely want reassurances that when the money goes to somewhere, that it's being spent properly, that it is a country we respect.
What is very important to us is that countries reform. And if they want grants on top of loans, something we don't want, actually, then you have to nail down very hard guarantees that reforms will be carried through.
And that's because countries such as Poland and Hungary have faced proceedings, it's called Article 7 sanctions from the European Union, because they've been undermining their judiciary. So the Dutch government says, well, we can't really justify to our parliament and to our taxpayers ladling debt onto ourselves, seeing loads of money given to the Polish and the Hungarians while they undermine the rule of law in their country. We can't have that. So they want controls. So the Dutch government want a control over that money.
We've both been to a fair few tense EU Council summits over the years. Was this as bad as you'd ever seen?
Yeah, I mean, it's not only as bad as I've ever seen. It's the leaders themselves were saying it's the worst. Xavier Bettel, the Prime Minister of Luxembourg, was saying it's the worst he's ever seen. And he comes to these things every 3 months. There were an awful lot of name calling. I mean, you've got Emmanuel Macron banging the desk, saying that Sebastian Kurz, the Chancellor of Austria, has a bad attitude. You have Viktor Orban describing the Dutch man, as he described him, the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, as a communist because he was trying to crush the dissent within the European Union, crush Hungary.
So I don't like blame game, but the Dutch man is the real responsible man for home as we have.
It's been really quite nasty and quite toxic.
For all that tension, they did get a deal. The northern so-called frugal states wanted a bit more of that 750 billion euros to be given in reimbursable loans rather than grants. And they did get a concession there, as well as a mechanism by which you can halt payments if countries are not being serious about economic reform. Interestingly, Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, said the British departure from the EU had shifted the balance and created a new dynamic, which I guess brings me to the final point. We began by saying that post-Brexit, the EU27 were desperate to pull together to show solidarity. They will hope that this agreement goes some way towards that. But is it fair to say that this COVID crisis has pushed European solidarity quite close to breaking point?
I think it's laid bare all the fragilities of the European Union. We've seen North pitted against South, East against West, and the EU institutions forced out of past crises were not able to respond effectively when the pandemic hit. There was certainly no shortage of selfish behaviour when the going got tough. But the leaders' summit did end with a deal. They're going to borrow, I mean, huge, vast sums together for the very first time. Italy can hope for as much as 5% of its national annual income from the new recovery fund. And the Prime Minister, Giuseppe Conte, is about to spend the money in a way that will rebuild faith in the European Union, which certainly has been shaken.
È un momento storico per l'Europa. È un momento storico per l'Italia.
So the leaders have a big job on their hands, but I think perhaps now they have the means to do it.
Daniel Boffi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Daniel Boffi, The Guardian's Brussels bureau chief. It is well worth your time to read his reporting at theguardian.com. It was part of a joint investigation between The Guardian and the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. It's part of our This Is Europe series, and the headline is Revealed, Italy's call for urgent help was ignored as coronavirus swept through Europe. Before we go, I just wanted to thank those of you who left us a review after I asked for them earlier in the week. There were some lovely ones in there, although one from someone called Unique Name sadly gave us one star in a review entitled Laughing Journalism that said, at least a third of the podcast was the presenter and guest laughing. I would just say, give me a break. It was John Crace and you would have laughed too. Thanks for lots of great responses on Twitter as well, especially around yesterday's episode on racism in schools. Do always fire your thoughts at us. I'm at Anushka Astana. Rachel is at Rachel_Hump. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys and Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. I hope you have a lovely weekend and we'll be back on Monday.